From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hope you had a great weekend, everyone. We're back in action now. Brian Kilmeade Show coming your direction. The number to call to be a part of it, 1-866-408-7669. So this hour, we're going to be joined by Congressman Ryan Zinke, the former Navy SEAL, looking for two more years, and maybe unless Donald Trump calls him again, would he answer yes? He's on the Appropriations Committee, co-chair of the Northern Border Security Caucus, which is more needed than ever, and also a member of the U.S. Joint Commission on China. Standing by is the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, and there's a lot of breaking news. Hunter Biden has now got into court. No word yet if he will testify today. If he doesn't, the jury could get this case today because defense is not supposed to have much of a defense. So let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
We will succeed. That was 3 years ago. Since then, 6.5 million migrants have been apprehended along the southern border. It would be very hard to call that a success.
Right, Martha Raddatz. It's actually coming down on Mayorkas. Do you believe that? Border matters to all of you. And this new executive order by Joe Biden has changed almost nothing. What has changed? 62% of the American people are on board with mass deportations of illegals.
Number two.
The forces came under fire from a 360-degree threat. RPGs, AK-47s, explosive devices on the way, mortar rounds. It was and is a war zone.
That is Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner. He's a spokesperson for the IDF. Four hostages rescued. One government minister resigns. And the pursuit of Hamas leadership continues. We have the latest from Gaza, including the dramatic rescue of four Israelis.
Number one.
We're going to do the things that you've wanted to do. We're going to bring it back to 4 years ago and do even more. We did, you know, people are saying to themselves, were we better off 4 years ago or are we better off now? And it wasn't even close.
The president's not wrong there, and we look at the numbers, 2024, Trump in full stride on the campaign trail, shaping his message and filling his election bank account, raking in millions out west while Biden takes shots at Republicans and his opponent while trying to boost his foreign policy approval numbers. We have the latest. So Zvika Klein joins us now, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. We've seen some of the dramatic footage from the helmet cam from the IDF special operators that went into Gaza and rescued four in different and two of which were in different locations. Zvika, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, how are you, Brian?
Great
to speak to you again.
First off, there's a lot going on. Benny Gantz has resigned his position in the coalition government. How damaging is that to the Prime Minister Netanyahu's government?
So it's very damaging. I mean, obviously, for those who don't understand, so basically, Netanyahu actually had a majority of members of Knesset before Gantz and his party, the National Unity Party, joined, you know, a bit after October 7th in order to form some sort of like a unity government, though it wasn't with all the relevant parties, but at least there was one party which is considered to be center or center-right, depending on who you ask. And add to the fact that Benny Gantz, as well as other members of his, you know, senior members of his party, were former chiefs of staff of the IDF. So these are people who are considered to be very highly appreciated in their military understanding. So there's less of a consensus for this government, which as it is does not have a lot of public support. And then now there's this whole discussion and a vote tonight at midnight Israel time about the conscription law, basically, of how we treat, how the Israeli government treats those ultra-Orthodox Jews, Israeli Jews, who do not enlist in the IDF. And it's a very hot topic because, you know, most Israelis go to the army and many people, almost everyone has lost a loved one since October 7th. So it's become a very toxic and a very sensitive issue.
So Benjamin Netanyahu stays in power. A lot has to do with the extreme right wing. And that extreme right wing includes Orthodox. And if you go ahead and start drafting them, he will lose support and that will collapse the government. The other thing to keep in mind is the Prime Minister of Defense, the Defense Minister Gallant, is being pressured by Benny Gantz to resign. He says, you resign too. Is there a chance Gallant leaves?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not just Benny Gantz. Obviously, he's publicly doing it. But, I mean, basically, Netanyahu actually about a year ago fired him and then kind of went back from actually doing, you know, the firing itself. Gallant is considered to be a more liberal, more of a liberal conservative in the Likud party. And therefore, even just like his surroundings are very different than the surroundings of other ministers. So he's more, he's part of the, you know, elite. He was a deputy chief of staff. So he's also very understanding of the security situation. But his family and his friends and his network is a lot more liberal than what he is, and definitely what this government is. So the pressure has been on him for a very long time, and there is so he basically will vote against this this vote tonight on that law, and there are talks of other ministers voting against, and then that also pretty much weakens the government, which is as it is in a very kind of complex and sensitive situation.
So let's talk about the hostage rescue. What took place? It looks like you guys have been working on this for weeks. It looks like the U.S. intelligence.
Two months. That's actually crazy. Yeah.
So working on it for 2 months, two separate locations. You get four out. Hamas says 270 others are killed. And and the idea, the Israelis say about 100 were killed. Could you describe this perilous situation? A lot of videos, some available, but could you tell us how this took place?
For those who want to, I mean, it's not a pretty sight. I mean, listen, it's not a pretty sight, but when you kidnap civilians and you hold them hostage for 8 months, a democratic country does what it needs to do. So this actually, as you said, this operation has been in works for 2 months. Most of the people involved in this operation actually did not know what they were going into, except for a very small group of elite, elite policemen. And the operation itself involved just almost every single part of the military, including the Air Force and the Navy, and the special unit who broke into these two separate apartments who are not very far from each other, but releasing Noor Arghamani, who was probably one of the more famous Israeli hostages, because videos of her being dragged by Palestinians into Gaza on October 7th while she was at a party at the Nova party. So she is considered to be one of like the symbols. She was in a separate apartment from these three men, two of them younger, one of them a bit older. And simultaneously, they broke into these places and very immediately killed the terrorists who were holding them, and simultaneously also just, you know, got them out and tried to get them to a helicopter. Actually, one of the jeeps on the way, you know, failed, and they had to release them by helicopter. So it was a very dramatic operation. The IDF was calling it pretty much like one of the more complicated and successful operations it has done, you know, since its existence. So it's very impressive. One soldier was unfortunately killed from a commando unit, but other than that, and then obviously there are different reports about those who are being killed. And we don't take Hamas's numbers for granted, because we've seen many times, including the UN, that acknowledge the fact that their numbers are incorrect. Definitely.
Right. So one of the people holding three hostages was a Gaza journalist who wrote for Al Jazeera, was holding three hostages in his home with his family before he was killed by those commandos. Really? Now, so people who wonder why Al Jazeera was kicked out of Jerusalem, maybe we know.
Yeah. So, I mean, so it's not totally clear, but from what I understand, he's a photographer or a freelance journalist, whatever, for Al Jazeera. And another person, I think, is his father, who's a doctor. And they were the ones who were holding Noor Arghamani. So it's definitely 100%. And, you know, even if he isn't an Al Jazeera journalist, let's say, he also is an official of, you know, of the authorities in Gaza. So it's not it's not just a Hamas issue here. We're talking about a broader sentiment, you know, the general Palestinian public being part of October 7th. It's not just a group of terrorists. It's a lot broader than that.
Zviga Klein joins us, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, to bring us inside what's happening in Gaza. So I want you to hear some of the ridiculous outrage from others who are more concerned about the Palestinians than they are for the hostages. Cut 24.
And I should say that while there are celebrations here in Israel, there is searing, searing grief inside of Gaza today. The health ministry there says at least 270 people were killed by Israeli fire during that raid. They say at least 60 of them were children. Our team in Gaza has seen hospital emergency rooms just absolutely overrun with the dead and dying. Just completely, completely heartbreaking scenes inside of Gaza. The Israeli military says Hamas deliberately holds the hostages inside of crowded civilian areas and that they called in targeted airstrikes to cover the retreat of the commandos. But it is clear a very large number of innocent people lost their lives inside of Gaza in the course of this rescue.
You've heard this reporting. Number one, don't kill 1,700 people for no reason. Don't take innocent people out of concerts in their homes. Don't murder them in front of their family and then torture them in captivity and then wonder why there isn't more humane behavior to get them out.
Yeah, I mean, Brian, I mean, I keep on agreeing with you. So, I mean, it's just crazy. I think any Western country and every Western journalist should understand that we're talking about terrorists and we're talking about terrorist nation and we're talking about people who raped and killed and are continuing to actually do so underground in Gaza. So I don't understand, you know, and if the world wasn't able to help Israel get them back, then how can the world blame Israel for taking care of its own citizens? I think any country,
right.
I would hope every country would do so, but, you know, maybe not.
So there's a report in, I think, Axios. It says President Biden enlisted Qatar and Egypt to pressure Hamas, and it backfired. This, according to the Wall Street Journal, they went on to say, Qatar and Egypt have told Hamas leaders in recent weeks that they face possible arrest, freezing of their assets, sanctions, and expulsion from their haven in Doha if they don't agree to a ceasefire with Israel. The threats were made at the behest of Biden, which is searching for a way to cajole a U.S.-designated terrorist group into striking a deal. The president needs, of course, for his own political fortunes. But after the threats were made, Hamas leader Hanaya, the head of the group's political exile in Qatar, said he wouldn't agree on a deal and it doesn't meet the group's conditions. So they're staring each other down right now. Do you have the same reports?
Yes, I do. But I will say that I think that I definitely know Qatar less from Egypt because I have less of a relationship there, but definitely from Qatar. This was in the talks for months that, you know, the next step up of pressure was to actually, you know, either kick out Hamas from Doha or, you know, as you said, freezing their accounts, making it a lot more difficult for them to operate. It's important to state that those in Doha are not actually those running the show. They're kind of like the, you know, kind of the emissaries of the leadership in Gaza. That said, you know, there's definitely a lot of pressure being put on from Qatar onto Hamas to change it. And this is a newer phenomenon. Didn't exist as much even a week or two ago. So I see it as a positive situation. And obviously they're just playing a game of negotiations, but I truly hope that, you know, this type of pressure, which the U.S. should have, you know, urged
of course
to take place a long time ago, but, you know, at least it's happening.
Real quick on the ceasefire talks, what could you tell us?
Yeah, so, I mean, again, so, I mean,
same
the ceasefire
thing?
Talks are very unclear if this operation actually sabotaged it or just not even being considered as part
but
of anything.
But did Netanyahu actually sign off on it and say yes?
He did, actually. Netanyahu did, and world leaders did.
Great. Listen, it's the most fluid situation in the world right now. We're all looking at it. If you have a chance to get four hostages out, you don't say, well, let me think about it. You plan and you react and you do it. And for people
also,
to be critical.
I just want to say one thing, Brian.
Yes.
These are three men who the I don't even know if they had any chance to get out of the deal. And even so, it would be in like a few rounds. That could be in like years from now. So, you know, it's a big deal.
Yeah, they wouldn't have been prioritized. They would have been women out first.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying. Exactly. Got it. Zvika Klein, the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, when we come back, I'll squeeze in some calls. We have more to go over. Hunter Biden, it looks like, will not testify. That means this whole thing could wrap up today and get to the jury. But there is some drama. A lot of Bidens are in the House. And guess who's in Delaware? The president. Will he make an appearance? Congressman Ryan Zinke at the bottom of the hour. Don't move.
politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think the politics are a loser. I think the best he can hope for is that the policy is right. And if the policy gets to a place where we have less of a crisis and less of an urgent issue at the border, then the politics can flow out of that. I agree with Susan. If they're talking about immigration and the border, that plays right into Donald Trump's hands. And I think the extent to which the Biden administration is able to downplay that or quell the disorder right now, then they're able to move on and talk about other issues. I don't see this, though, any way, the polling will bear it out, any way that this is a winner for President Biden.
And what that is Rick Klein of ABC, who's just, you know, he pretty much goes down the middle. He's really good. He comes on, he used to come on before he got the ABC contract with Brett Baer all the time. He came on here, too. But he's just saying, look, right now in the polling, it's overwhelming, double digits. The President Trump destroys Joe Biden, and this legislation is not going to do much to change that. What they're always going to lean on is, well, they had a bipartisan deal. Good luck with that, because we already have 8 million people coming through before a bipartisan deal came about. Remember how it came about? It's because he wasn't able to get foreign aid. And in return, the House said, if you want to get foreign aid, do something on the border. So they started negotiating on a border deal. But most Republicans didn't like it, including the former president. And then Democrats said, we got a talking point. They walked away from legislation that would have helped. Here's Martha Raddatz. Even she on ABC wasn't buying it. Cut 31.
I want to go back to an interview I did with you in March of 2021, 2 months into your tenure as DHS secretary. You seemed totally confident then that you had that under control. Let's listen to what you told me.
We have seen large numbers of migration in the past. We know how to address it. We have a plan. We are executing on our plan, and we will succeed.
We will succeed. That was 3 years ago. Since then, 6.5 million migrants have been apprehended along the southern border. It would be very hard to call that a success.
Martha, remember something, that migration is a dynamic phenomenon. It is something that we alone are, it's not just us who is experiencing it, throughout the region and throughout the world.
So I love that question, because she puts on, Martha Raddatz destroys Donald Trump, just hates him, cried, literally cried when he won. But she knows when she's being lied to. Mayorkas flat out lied over and over again. Does not tell the truth. When people went to impeach him, they rallied around him when Republicans went to impeach him. But over and over again, he's saying, I can't do anything about it. We're doing everything we can. We're deporting people. It's a mass migration. The globe is moving countries. We're just the latest example of it. All not true. And that's why I have there's very few people I have less respect for on the planet or in government than Secretary Mayorkas. He is an embarrassment. And right now, the polls overwhelmingly for Trump on the border.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. It's Congressman Ryan Zinke showing no discipline with the microphone wide open.
Hey,
the congressman from Montana, former Secretary of the Interior, who was so responsible. We did 56, What Made America Great. We did about six together. Two that stand out, Statue of Liberty was unbelievable.
And going into the articulating arm and standing at the torch.
Which no one stand. It's been closed. It's been closed forever. So we get to the crown, and I thought it was great. And I go, would it be possible to get to the torch? And he said, well, I don't see why not. And then the park ranger with us said, no, we can't get to the torch. And you said, I think we can. He goes, and they looked at you.
Does that require a waiver? And who would sign the waiver? Right. Let's go show it, America, what the torch looks like.
And
we did. It was
skinny
brilliant.
Stairs straight
absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And you know, it's isolated, and people were worried after 9/11 that was going to be a terror. That was going to be a terror target. That was something you were Navy SEAL at that point in 9/11.
Well, it remains a concern. You know, quite frankly, on the immigration piece is going to segue into that. Look, we don't know who's in this country. And I've been down to the border. You know, we can start off with the immigration. We don't have a border. People just walk across and say, I live in fear. And then they're processed. They're processed within an hour. If they have a medical ailment, they're seen on your taxpayer dollars fixed. Yeah, it's a mess. And, you know, all of a sudden you see it in every street across America is, look, this is a big issue, and we don't know who's in this country. The FBI is constantly, you know, lighting smoke flares on the horizon because we're going to get hit again.
So this is not going to make you happy, but Bill Malusian was talking to the CBP over the weekend, names not given, and said, and along with Griff Jenkins, Fox News obtained internal Border Patrol memo that was sent out to agents in San Diego sector, instructing them to release single adults from all but six countries in the Eastern Hemisphere because they are hard or very hard to remove. The memo is attached and sent out after President Biden's executive order banning asylum for most illegal crossers who don't go to the port of entry. How angry does that make you?
Very angry. What makes me angry is we're not doing our primary mission is protecting the American people. Now, northern border, look, it's wide open, too. You know, I sit on the co-chairman of the Northern Border Caucus. And, you know, people are just walking across. We've seen more individuals on the terrorist watch list are coming across the northern tier, the southern tier. There is no border. And look, this policy has got to come to a stop.
And it's going to bankrupt us, too, along the way. So Russia, Georgia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Moldova, Kyrgyzstan are our mandatory referral countries.
It is outrageous. And
let alone the Chinese.
Just because you're in this country doesn't mean you're a good or a bad fellow, right? And here's what's astonishing and I think disappointing is there are hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people that have done it right, filled out the application. They've been vetted. Well, why don't we incentivize immigration the right way rather than incentivizing the wrong way? And it seems like this administration loves to incentivize doing everything the wrong way. Enough's enough.
And, you know, I asked you in particular, I have this person close to my family who's from Canada and went to college and played hockey here. And they want to be able to work here. And they've done everything right, pristine record. I mean, dry everything great, grades through the roof, got a job. They still were not able to get it. And they had to go cross the border and then come back in. And it was still the cost and the time and the lawyer fees to do it. But at the end, if everybody was doing this, I'd say, well, it's hard to get into America, the best country in the world. But to see other people breach it and say, see me in 12 years? Well, crazy?
It incentivizes wrong behavior.
So when you just write off
student loans, a student loan is a loan, right? That's a contract. We're just going to blow through that and incentivize doing the wrong thing and the border. And now it's a national security issue. And we have a lot of bad people in this country that we got to attend to. They can't continue to be here.
I mean, you saw the terror attack over in Russia. You see what's going on in Israel. You see the fact that they look at us as the problem in Israel and even our own country. What I saw over the weekend was so sickening. I saw a handful of park rangers be chased from the park right across the street from the White House by pro-Palestinian and outwardly pro-Hamas protesters calling for a jihad in our country across from the White House and no arrest. They defiled the Andrew Jackson statue, horrible things they wrote on that, colored their hands in red. And all these other statues around there, they defiled everything. No arrests.
And Hamas, it's a terrorist organization. Is it any different than ISIS? Is it any different than Al-Qaeda?
They're more organized.
So you have a terrorist organization within our streets, and you have American citizens protesting with them. You know, when you look at the Ayatollah Khomeini, In some of his statements, you know, if you're a female in custody, he advocates rape before they kill you so you don't go to heaven. That's a quote. So, you know,
those are the people praising the American protesters.
Yeah, and death to America. So this is your alternative? So, you know, we got to reel this in.
So there was video showing vandals defacing the statue of General Conte de Rochambeau, member of the French general that played such a role in our revolution, over in Lafayette Park. You could see right now the graffiti still on the Andrew Jackson statue right outside the White House over in Lafayette Square. So it's absolutely sickening. So if you were President Trump and you're in office, you know what you're doing? You're sending National Guard over there to clear that out if the D.C. cops can't do it. And guess what? In a previous administration, first administration you were in, they probably would have had a problem with that. I think America's changed. I don't think that America would mind a crackdown on these protesters outside these schools, stopping these highways and destroying property. I think America's changed on this.
Well, and it comes down to, I think, sometimes a single word called respect. You respect public property. You respect law enforcement. You respect law and order. And when you tolerate, in many cases, incentivize a disrespectful and conduct that Americans seen outrageous, and that's right. Where we sit in this election, because there's a gap where America really is and where this administration is. There's a huge gap in woke warfare, in foreign ops, in inflation, domestic, across the board. I can't think of one victory this administration that has had that is in line with where America is.
And what's interesting, you didn't say conservative or Republican. You did say, can we bring back logic? Can we bring back common sense? And that's what it is. The president, the former president, is actually running on the common sense platform. He's not asking for something that we shouldn't be doing already, right? I mean,
well, yeah, and I said, you know, for a while that, look, this election, Trump is a movement. It is now beyond just a candidate. It's beyond Donald J. Trump as a person. This is a movement. America wants to trust our government. America doesn't want to be pushed around on foreign shores. America wants to have a thriving economy. America wants to make sure that the American dream's available for, you know, buying a house. But all those things are diminishing under this administration that is globalist, and climate change is they are willing to do anything in pursuit of those goals.
Because as you know, once we get common sense back, well, on our border, start getting a solid foreign policy, rebuilding our military, stop mandating electric cars, destroying the car industry, subsidizing things, being responsible with the environment. You're the Interior Secretary. You care about the environment as much as anybody. You saw it up close, but you got to be responsible for it, right? You got to be responsible for the economy. And China's building a coal fire plant a week, and we're destroying ourselves to buy rare earth from them.
Here's the irony. The first 2 years of the Trump administration, when I was secretary, both on the environment and energy, we went from zero to hero. Environment, the Great American Outdoors Act was the largest investment in our public lands, about infrastructure, forests, our parks, because our parks were falling apart, ever. And energy, in 2 years, we went from 8.7 million barrels a day and declining, beholden by foreign interests. 2 years, 12.5, we were the king of the hill on energy. Gas was $2 a gallon. The economy was rolling. You know, when fuel costs are low, America can produce goods and services. When fuel costs rise and we become less competitive, America goes into where we are. It's tough going. In our economy, we feel it.
So the president over the weekend raised $12 million in Silicon Valley. I mean, this is unbelievable. Dave, we understand that this was put together by J.D. Vance, and they had a huge, huge event. Now he's at $291 million, 150 mile, 100, he's at 200, he's at, let me see, $150 million he's raised. Biden has raised $89 million, $35 million more than Trump's $49 million. So a shocker, Trump is up by five in Nevada. He's up in Arizona by four, but Florida only by four because abortion's on the ballot. On climate change, Biden beats Trump by 12. On abortion, Biden beats Trump by 11. On health care, Biden by five. On election integrity, it's even. Our Iran-Hamas war, Trump by 13. Economy, Trump by 16. immigration, Trump by 22. So if you're Trump and you're looking at this, he's trying to go for health care now. He's saying, I can get that number down on health care.
Well, and he's also, look, you know, let's look at the service industry. He said, you know, tips, right? Because this president understands that, hey, if you're in the service industry, things are a little tough right now. Right. So looking at it, you know, more money. So
what if I stop taxing tips?
Yeah. You look at the economy. All right. There are certain drivers. Number one is you got a Biden administration that's killing American energy. So that's why gas and goods, the spending's out of control with Biden. So we're paying for inflation. And quite frankly, you look at the regulatory framework of this administration. So on those fronts, Trump's ahead. I think if I was Biden, you know, I'd be worried. But I'm not sure that his decision making. And I've been associated with the president, met him back and forth since he's been in on some event, and you can see
Joe Biden.
Yes, you can see his diminishing state.
Right.
I mean, and it's sad overseas, and America sees, and they can't hide it anymore because it's clear.
Here's the president's message on Sunday. Cut three.
When he indicted me over nothing, they opened up a whole new box. And then I got indicted again and again and again. I was never indicted in a period of this little tiny period of time. I was like a ping pong ball. Sir, they indicted you here. They indicted you in Georgia. They indicted you in New York. Then they indicted you again in New York, sir. And it was all over. Can I use that word again? But you'll use it. A disgrace. A disgrace. And what they've done is they've weaponized the Department of Justice.
Now, when you were in the office, you were targeted.
Oh, yeah. It was funny because they were aiming at President Trump at the time. They just didn't have the range. So they were hitting me. But all of us in the Trump administration, they couldn't beat us by policy, but they beat us up by nefarious and, outrageous
claims. Technically, you guys were in power. So when you're not in power, you don't have the power, and when you're in power, do you have the power?
I can tell you, we all knew there was a deep state. We all knew it. So as a Montana tongue-in-cheek, I brought a pair of hip waders because I was going to the swamp. Should have brought a boat. And what we're seeing now is the deep state is much, much deeper, and it's weaponized in many cases. So the arms are supposed to be free of bias. You see how deeply biased they are and vindictive. And they went too far with President Trump. And I think America knows, hey, look, we've got to correct this course.
I want to talk about Montana, the Senate race, your race, when we come back with Ryan Zinke. He's in studio. Go to BrianKilmeadShow.com. You can actually see the video. We're Fox Nation. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Congressman Ryan Zinke is with me now. Congressman, first on your race. Never easy over in Montana. You guys, what, two congressional seats?
Yeah, it's interesting. Montana won. When I was a congressman at large, I represented Montana when Montana had won. And now we have two. And the districts are uniquely different. The Western District, I won by three last election. John Tester, the senator, won by 13. This is a battleground state in two ways. There's three objectives on the Republican side. One is we got to hold the House. Otherwise, day one, Donald Trump's going to get impeached. And looking at the numbers.
If he wins.
If he wins, I'm thinking we're going to win. Come on, guys. We got to focus on that. And secondly, we got to advance in the Senate. It's a 10-year play, just number of Republicans up, vulnerable, the number of Democrats vulnerable. This is a 10-year play, and we got a great candidate, Tim Sheehy.
Tell me about him.
All right, former SEAL, entrepreneur, young guy, exciting. I pinned the bronze star on him. His link to Montana, great story, real short. Him and his wife are overseas fighting. He's married a Marine, Semper Fi. And Montana is one of those states when you can get married in absentia. And he and his wife got married, Montana marriage license, when they were fighting overseas. And he came back. He developed a couple companies. One of them went NASDAQ. Just a superstar. And tell you, as a former SEAL, when you have an individual with that much talent, put him in, coach. So and the Senate needs an injection.
He's trailing by a couple of 3 or 4 points right now.
Well,
Tester will outraise him.
Tester will outraise him, and in many ways, this is a featured race because John Tester is a former chair of the senatorial, and Steve Daines, now the veteran senator from Montana, is the chair of the Republican side. So it brings, you know, huge access to capital. It's going to be a $200 million race. But I tell you what, the momentum is behind Tim Sheehy. He started out with zero. He's at 44. John Tester started out with 42. And after $15 million of ads convincing everyone that John Tester's a gun-toting, security-minded farmer, people aren't buying it. Because finally, I think people are getting to know that John Tester is really two-tone. There's campaign John we love, and there's real John that we don't like the way he votes.
Is Mitch McConnell and company getting behind Tim Sheehy?
I think everyone is on the Republican side, including the president.
Well, with money?
With money, too. In this race, you know, Montana, look, we have just over a million people. It's the same size as from Washington, D.C. to Chicago, plus 45 miles. Really big state. So when you have that much amount, you know, that much money being poured into very few people, you know, mailboxes are going to be full. You're not going to be able to turn on a TV.
There's only so much money.
There's only so much. It's going to be, I hate you. Well, I hate you worse. And I think what Montana is feeling, look, our economy is not going in the right direction. John Tester has been had a long history of saying something but doing something different. And I think we need to change.
And Congressman Zinke, I will say this. We only have 40 seconds left. But it was Joe Manchin took the slings and arrows.
Absolutely.
It was Senator Sinema who took the slings and arrows from Republicans and Democrats. It was not John Tester. He says he's a moderate, but he never took a difficult stand.
No, and look, Montana won my district. You know, I won by three. It's a tight race. The Dems going to try to get the vote out of the college and stuff like that and mislead people. But we can win the race. And follow us at RyanZinke.com. And, hey, there's five seals now. We think we can get maybe seven seals and one in the Senate. Plus, we'll have four special forces. Look, we're going to have a whole squad in there. So follow us at SealPack.org.
That's awesome. America's better off for it. Thanks so much, Congressman. Always great to see you.
Always great to see you.
All right, guys.
God bless. Keep it
here. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. We come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, around the world. Happy to be on WTIC today over in Hartford. It's a thrill to be on over in Connecticut. I was actually on. There's a sports guy years ago over in Hartford on the NBC affiliate. This hour, I'm going to be joined by Michael Goodwin of the New York Post, as well as Jamie Metzl. Jamie Metzl is one of these guys. He goes, listen, Brian, I'm a Democrat, but what's happening with this COVID-19, we're not getting the true story, and they're not doing a real investigation. He reached out to me on Twitter, and he DM'd me. And then I thought, let me just call this guy. And he educated me so much, and he took such a strong stand, and they could not touch his credibility. He's got a brand new book out called Super Convergence, How the Genetics, Biotech, and AI Revolutions Will Transform Our Lives, Work, and World. That's how smart he is. I'm lucky to say the sentence, let alone do the research. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
We will succeed. That was 3 years ago. Since then, 6.5 million migrants have been apprehended along the southern border. It would be very hard to call that a success.
That is Martha Raddatz. Even ABC cannot let Mayorkas get away with saying they've been successful at the border. The border matters to all of you. And that's what the polls say. A new executive order by Joe Biden has changed little. That's what we're hearing at the border. What has changed? 62% of the American people are on board with President Trump's idea of mass deportations of illegals.
Number two.
The forces came under fire from a 360-degree threat. RPGs, AK-47s, explosive devices on the way, mortar rounds. It was and is a war zone.
Four hostages rescued. Our one government minister resigns, and the pursuit of Hamas leadership continues. We have the latest from Gaza, including the dramatic rescue of four Israelis.
Number one.
We're going to do the things that you've wanted to do. We're going to bring it back to 4 years ago and do even more. We did, you know, people are saying to themselves, were we better off 4 years ago or are we better off now? And it wasn't even close.
That is President Trump over the weekend. Man, he was happy. He was in Nevada. He was in Newport Beach. and he was at Silicon Valley. 2024, Trump in full stride. He's out west, raking in millions. Biden still has more. While Biden takes shots at Republicans overseas at D-Day events and from Normandy on down. Every chance he had. Well, sorry, Ukraine, the aid is late. Republicans were holding out on us. I'm sorry, you're an isolationist. I'm somebody who understands alliances, not an isolationist. We are somebody who knows what it's like to have friends. That's a shot at Trump because he's been critical of NATO allies for not paying their fair share. And he spent a lot of time. Now, number one, the story with Ukraine is not the delay of money. That's an old story. How about the money that's been given by Congress, $65 billion, none of it's arrived in armaments. None. That's the story. Why don't you take responsibility for it? Michael Goodwin joins us now. Michael, you were not happy with President Biden's D-Day speeches.
Good morning, Brian. No, I thought it was shameful. I thought that, he was trying to copy Ronald Reagan's amazing 1984 speech. It's always kind of fascinating to me, Brian. The 1984 speech, of course, was the 40th anniversary, and here we are 40 years later, and it is still the gold standard for Normandy speeches. But in trying to copy Reagan's speech and talk about the Army Rangers who climbed the cliffs and from the same spot that Reagan gave the speech. And by the way, anybody who's never been there, I urge you to go. There's no place like Normandy in the sense that you really see what the invading troops were up against. I mean, the cliffs are still there. The bunkers are still there. The bomb craters. It's an extraordinary place to visit. And of course, the majestic cemetery that just overwhelms. But at any rate, I thought Biden's effort was misguided to even try to replicate Reagan's speech. I mean, he didn't have to give it there. He didn't have to give a speech about the Army Rangers or anything like that. But in doing that, he and his team tried to capture the Reagan spirit. Of course, he fell flat on that. But I thought most shameful was that Reagan's speech, as Peggy Noonan describes it, because she wrote most of the speech, it was at a time of great tension in Europe. There was a lot of the kind of peacenik arms control groups, anti-nuclear groups, were only infecting the West, not the Soviet Union at the time. And he went there not just to remember the Army Rangers who scaled the cliffs on Omaha and Utah beaches, but also to rally the people and the leaders of Europe not to knuckle under to the Soviet threat, not to try to accept the continuation of Soviet domination in Eastern Europe. And Biden went there not with great visions, but to just get reelected. And so his speech is peppered with these democracy allusions, which are, of course, all about Trump. And he never mentions Trump's name, but he talks about will America rally again as it did in 1944, this year. I mean, it's all about his own reelection. It's a selfish, small-minded approach. And again, I think really unpatriotic to use that moment to agitate for his own reelection. And as you pointed out with the apology to Zelensky, apologizing for our system of government that allows the House and the Senate debates to deliberate and reach different conclusions and then compromises. It was disgraceful.
But not only that, it's not even timely. This is a March. That's a March story. You know what the story is now? Execution, as usual. We can't get things on time. You should be on the phone blasting people, threatening people. You better, the Secretary of Defense, do something for a change. I don't want a speech. I don't want you to disappear again for 3 weeks and not tell anybody. I want you leaning on the Pentagon to deliver the pallets of weapons in order for them to hold on to Kharkiv, because if they lose the second biggest city in the country, it's open field running. So that leads one to believe. I watch his speech. You watch him barely get around, and you wonder, what's the world thinking? James Carville weighed in with John Castamatidis over the weekend. Cut 10.
We have a choice to make in November, and it isn't a choice that I was crazy about. I actually was very public that I thought that President Biden should not run for re-election, but he did, and it's him and Trump, and that's where I am, and I'm 1,000% behind President Biden.
So he doesn't want him to run. I think more people, then I read The Atlantic over the weekend, and Mark Leibovich writes a column, and he's no right-wing conservative columnist. He's not a conservative columnist at all, but he just said that right now, after this verdict, it seemed to have sparked something akin to activation energy among Republicans. And he's now taking on to the nickname Ruth Bader Biden. He held on too long. And he goes, The Atlantic takes him on just like the Wall Street Journal editorial took him on.
Yeah. Look, there is no love for Joe Biden in America. I mean, at most, there's pity. I mean, the New York Times, of course, trying to resurrect him, writes about the Hunter Biden case as though it's all just about drugs and the poor fellow and all of that and the poor women around him, without touching on the core issue, of course, which is the gun and the lying. And you would think the New York Times, which is such an anti-gun outlet, would seize on the opportunity here to make an example of the president's son. Instead, it's all about, you know, he's a drug addict, poor fellow. And I think that's the attitude of many, many on the left now. They are in a pitying phase of Joe Biden. But Americans don't want a leader they have to pity. I mean, that's a pathetic idea of what the presidency should be. And I dare say, I mean, even when FDR was paralyzed, he didn't ask for pity. He wanted people not to know about his disability so that he could act fully as president. And here's Joe Biden. I mean, he tells these stories that are simply lies. They're not embellishments. Well, you know, so, they're not charming.
Did you hear this? Did you see the New York Times, a place you used to work?
Yes.
They did this story about why Joe Biden keeps making things up. And let's get down on this. You know, let's break down what he's saying. And one of the things they asked him, number one, did you really have an uncle that got shot down? Well, maybe, but he wasn't eaten by cannibals.
No, he was lost at sea. I mean, the plane was ditched at sea, not on the beach. But, Brian,
he suggested he was a civil rights warrior.
Yes.
And he wasn't. He said he joined at 16, the NAACP. He joined in 28 years old. They're trying to find out any proof that he ever got or received any recommendation to go to West Point. He keeps telling that story. Said he was brought up in a Puerto Rican church and a black church. Then he said he stood up on a black porch when a black family was harassed in Delaware, and he stood on a porch with them to stare them down. No one has any proof of that. He didn't do it. In fact, in the past, he says, I was no civil rights activist. He said that in the 80s.
Have they found corn pop yet?
Yeah. I mean, so even the New York Times wrote about this.
Yeah, but and I think that, you know, he's constantly trying to paint a picture of himself, right? I mean, he's the Walter Mitty of politicians, you know. Everything that happened, he was there. You know, he was a civil rights leader. He was arrested in South Africa. I mean, he just makes these things up to make himself something he's not. I mean, the very fact that he has to lie, right? If you had a friend, Brian, who was constantly lying about his life, wouldn't you suspect that the friend is really a pathetic character who knows, who views his own life as a failure and therefore has to falsely create a new one for himself? I mean, why? We have a president of the United States who goes around doing this. Even when the Baltimore Bridge collapsed, I was on that bridge many times on Amtrak. No, there are no train tracks on that bridge. So he just puts himself at every story in some way as though he can relate to it. I mean, you know, sadly, he keeps doing it with his son, Bo. He tries to relate to military families by saying it. I mean, it is pathetic. And I think that's what Carvel is getting at, that we have essentially a pathetic, sad president, and we pity him, so, but we hate Donald Trump, so we'll vote for him anyway.
Right. So you
I don't think most people would feel it that way.
Barack Obama did the same thing with Mitt Romney, made him unelectable, a rich white guy who hates little people, and it might have worked. I mean, that's how they marginalized him after his terrible debate. But we know Mitt Romney's not like that. Never was, but he could not. He was spending his time in the Mormon church rebuilding the homes of poor people. But for some reason, he was able to they were able to label him as that. Meanwhile, here's Chris Matthews and Andrew McCabe. I want you to hear what they said about Donald Trump. Cut 13. Chris Matthews.
I'm telling you, Trump could end up rolling the score. I've got the Congress. I've got the Supreme Court. I own it all. I am a dictator. It's very reasonable to assume that's where he's headed.
Andrew McCabe, cut 14.
I mean, people are actually worried about being thrown in jail or grabbed in some sort of extrajudicial detention. And I think, you know, as crazy as this sounds in the United States of America, I think people should really consider that these are possibilities.
Really? He didn't do it for 4 years. Didn't even get Hillary Clinton. But look out. He's going to jail you and become a dictator.
Yeah, look, that's their only shot, right? That's the only thing they can do is scare people about a Trump presidency. The problem with that, of course, is which party is actually trying to lock up its opponent. It's not Donald Trump. It's Joe Biden. And which party tried to keep Donald Trump off the ballot? Which party is trying to bankrupt him with civil procedures? All of the cases against Trump involve Democrats. And so this idea that somehow Trump is a threat to democracy is one of the great lies. It is the Democrats who are trying to lock up their opposition. If that isn't a threat to democracy, what is? And what about opening the border to allow in 10 or 12 million illegal immigrants? Isn't that a threat to democracy? Isn't it a threat to America? Which party's doing that? I mean, look, Donald Trump.
You're ready
Trump
for the debate,
no
Michael. You are ready for the debate.
Donald Trump is no angel, but he's not doing the things that the Democrats are doing, and yet they accuse him. I mean, this, as I say, this is one of the three great lies of political history.
I just love over the weekend the other channels are trying to say he's going to go for revenge. Number one, it's interesting. You know that he deserves to want revenge, but if he does say it, they're going to go get him. What he always says is, my revenge will be success. And then they said, you know, you could play, you know, Dr. Phil would do a follow up and say, you know, I understand that the feeling of revenge. He goes, yeah, your revenge sometimes takes time. That's the clip they run with. But you know the deal. And so does the record people.
Day one, right? That whole day one thing. You know, will you be a dictator only on day one? Ah, he's going to be a dictator starting on day one. They changed it. I mean, that's what they do.
Go get him, Michael Goodwin. Thank you.
My pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
When we come back, I'm going to take your calls and then talk to Jamie Metzl, the future of AI, genetics, biotech, how it's going to change everything we do. And I want to touch on Game 2, Celtics and Mavs, as I head to Dallas tomorrow night to Chris and KLIF. Now I'm in that lineup, and I'm thrilled. And I'll be doing the show from there on Wednesday. So hope to see everybody there in person. Don't move.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I love Kamala Harris comes out over the weekend and say, well, about Trump's trial. Well, cheaters don't like to get caught. Did you follow the trial at all? Do you understand what this whole thing was about? It wasn't about if someone cheated or not cheated. It talks about records. And it talks, I don't want to go through it again. But she just goes, everyone cheers. I don't think anybody's been impressed with her. But the other thing is, you got a huge problem with your own ticket and with Joe Biden. You know the accusations that flew his way. And you know what a mess that Hunter Biden is. Also, denying as a father, grandfather, and a father that London Roberts is carrying your baby only to find out it's been proven that she has and refusing to pay child support and then have to go to court because of it and having some high-profile attorney and donors fly you in and out of that trial. London Roberts is writing a book about her whole experience, and she seems like a nice person by all accounts. Here's a little of her interview.
I had two cell phones at the time because my Arkansas phone had a cellular data that didn't pick up at the place that I was living in D.C. So I got Sprint and AT&T to even out the data and everyone could reach me. But that night, they both at the same time crashed and in front of me and my friends.
And what did the screens look like when they were crashing?
You know how they'll go like black with those like lines and stuff across them, the like green and purple looking lines.
The next day you go and get a new phone, right? And you are able to like link it up with your cloud. And what do you discover?
Yes. A lot of stuff is gone from my iCloud had it not been backed up or whatever, but just about everything with Hunter was gone.
Just a coincidence. Everybody knows. No, nothing to see here. Keep walking, everybody. London Roberts. She's going to be a real paranoid to the Biden family.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Welcome back, everybody. We're keeping up with everything going on with the Hunter Biden trial, too. I'm not going to just say goodbye to that, but we understand that Hunter is not going to be testifying. This whole thing could wrap up shortly while the Bidens are actually there. With me in studio is a great guest, Jamie Metzl. You've heard him before on our show. He's got a brand new book. It's officially out tomorrow. Yep. It's called Super Convergence, The genetics, biotech, and AI revolutions will transform our lives, work, and world. Wow. I mean, the fact that you would think to yourself, I could handle, I could put something underneath that title just shows your intellect and your experience.
Well, you're sweet to say, Brian. I mean, we are living through this hugely transformative moment, not just in our lives, but in all of human habitation on Earth. And the two big stories of this moment are human-engineered intelligence and human re-engineered life. After 3.8 billion years of evolution, our one species suddenly is able to create these kinds of new futures. And the biggest question for all of us and for our futures is, can we do so wisely? That's what this book is about in a really accessible way. I want people reading this book on the beach is to say, hey, what's going on? What are the implications? How do I fit into this story? And what are the really practical things that I can do today for myself and for the world to make sure it's as positive as an experience as possible?
Because a lot of people aren't comfortable with the fact that this is happening and we're not all over it. I'm not comfortable with the fact that I am not ahead or with AI. You know, it's a, well, what do you do with those iPhones? You know, if you're 80 and you see kids on iPhones, well, it doesn't matter. I'm not comfortable with letting everything pass me by. So this book will catch me up.
That's the goal. It's trying to not just to catch you up, but to say it's not enough to be caught up. It's that if we're going to have the best possible future, you and all your listeners and everybody has to have a role in building that future that we'd like to inhabit ethically and just even practically. Like if you have a business, you have to kind of understand what's changing so that you can make sure that your business is evolving with the times. Just as you and I were talking just before we went live about students in school, and you need to understand, it's not just AI, it's the title of the book, Super Convergence. It's these multiple technologies where every technology is embedded in every other technology. We don't think about it this way, Brian, but the agricultural revolution is what allowed us to have writing and cities and civilizations. And then the writings, like every time you use computer code, it's ancient Phoenician letters are the foundation of those computer codes. Like that's what the computer code looks like. And then computer code makes the computer revolution possible, makes the machine learning revolution, AI. And then using the tools of AI, we're able to understand designs that have evolved in nature over billions of years. Something simple like how does a plant distribute nutrients through a leaf? Well, it's interesting to know that. But once you know that, you can make better computer chips based on those kinds of designs, and that speeds up the AI, and that speeds up our ability to manipulate the world around us. So it's a really big, it's a really exciting story. If we get it right, we can feed people, we can save the environment, we can do all these, help, you can cure cancers. And if we get it wrong, a lot of horrible things can happen.
So first off, let everybody at home understand your background that led you to believe you could write a book like this.
You know, that you'd have to bring my mother on the show, but
Where'd you go to college?
So, educationally, I went to Brown undergrad. I have a PhD from Oxford and a law degree from Harvard Law School. And connected to this, 27 years ago, I was serving on the National Security Council for President Clinton. And my then boss and currently close friend, Richard Clark, who maybe you know, he was the guy who essentially predicted 9/11. He'd worked under Democratic administrations, under Republican administrations, and he was unable, unfortunately, to do anything about it. But what he said was the key to efficacy in Washington, where I then lived, and life is to try to solve problems that most people can't see. And so almost three decades ago, I felt very strongly that these emerging tools of AI, genetics, and biotechnology were going to change the world around us. So I became obsessed, and I taught myself the science. Like right now, I lecture to top scientists around the world. And when I was at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, I said, I'm about to speak to you about the future of biology. But if you hear something that sounds wrong, raise your hand, because I'm self-taught. And the last biology course I took was in high school. But as someone who had to teach myself the science, I don't have the luxury of jargon. At every step, I have to understand what's happening to get to the next level. And so what I've tried to do is create a book where if you don't have any background, if you just say, well, I get this feeling, like you just said, in my gut, something really big is changing. And it's scary, not just because it's changing, but I don't understand it the way I've understood things in the past. This is a book for you. And because of this super convergence, quote unquote, of technologies, the rate of change, of technological change, is advancing. And we have very practical brains for good reason. That's a great survival skill historically. But that means when change is accelerating, if you look in the rearview mirror to understand the speed of change, you're in many cases going to be too conservative.
Very interesting. So first off, how do they all work together? You say convergence. Yeah. You know, biotech, I find the most rewarding type of investing, because what's better than that?
Yeah.
I love the free market. I love that you have to have the notion in research in order to spot that small laboratory working in Italy that might have some promise when it comes to solving a major disease or something, or hair loss or something like that. So then you put that, you take a bet and you get the money and you get the invest and you pull that forward and you hope it gets to market and you hope the FDA gives it the green light. So how does all this work together?
So biotechnology is part of these super converging technologies. Because if you just had the smartest humans in the world without machines, and you said, all right, here's human biology, figure out what's happening inside of a human, we just couldn't do it. The reason why we have biotechnology is that we have all of these new capabilities. Like, you've heard of genome sequencing, and now we're sequencing all sorts of things. So we've turned biology, which used to be a field of magic, into a computational field where we have all of this data. And we're looking for patterns. Like my father right now, it's a miracle story. I don't write about it as much in the book. But my dad has the Steve Jobs type of cancer. And when he had this diagnosis almost 2 years ago, he shouldn't be alive now. But I was writing the healthcare chapter of this book about the future of cancer care, about how the tools of AI and genome sequencing and all of these things were going to transform healthcare and cancer care. And so I said, we need to sequence everything. And we found a mutation in his cancer that we could target with a drug. My dad is now thriving. He's actually here in New York for the book launch tomorrow. And his oncologist has already published a case report in the Journal of GI Cancer saying that my dad, he was the only person with this kind of cancer and this kind of mutation ever treated in this way, that this is a model for treating people with this same kind of cancer. None of that would have been possible without AI, genetics, biotechnology, and all of these capabilities coming together.
So, for example, would you put it in ChatGPT and say, these are the cancers, this is what we have, this is what he's been doing, and then that gives you an answer, or is it something sophisticated?
It's more sophisticated than that, but now that we have this case study, now that there is a report and it's online, now somebody who goes to ChatGPT, when
it goes into
that,
the brain.
That field of common knowledge. So it's not just ChatGPT. So ChatGPT and the large learning models are really important, but that's just one piece of this. When I lecture about this, the way I say is, if I ask you, Brian, to describe how electricity has influenced your life today, you can't even answer.
Where do you even start?
It's everywhere. It's in this table, this microphone, in our clothes, in our haircuts. It's everywhere. And that's right now when we think of AI, we think, oh, AI is ChatGPT. But it's going to be that in everything there is AI. And whether that means that our people who write computer codes or who over the last year, coders, the elite coders have gotten about 50% faster because they're working alongside these AI co-pilots, we can call them. But we're getting to a point where you won't even need to know computer code to do coding. Like you could say, hey, machine, whatever it is, write me a computer program to make the lights switch on and off every 15 minutes, and then you'll just get it. So now we don't have a few million computer coders. We have billions. And then how does that speed things up? And when we are doing computer codes, coding, we're learning from the machines, but the machines are learning from us. And so we're going to get to this point where machines are better and better at writing their code. And that could be the greatest moment in human history where we solve all of these problems, or it could be the Terminator moment in human history. And that's why I've written this book, because determining which path we're on is based on decisions that we make now. And it's not going to be by people who understand everything. It's going to be about people who understand something. And I really wanted to give people an on-ramp into this. Say, hey, in a friendly way. I want people to feel like, hey, I'm going on a friendly journey with someone who's not trying to scare me, but who respects me as a reader, wants to bring me into the conversation. And then I want to feel empowered that I have a role. And whether that's role is discussing these topics, people in your church groups, in your family, elected officials, this really needs to be part of our public dialogue.
So that's why the author, Jamie Metzl, is in our studio. Tomorrow his book comes out. It's called Super Convergence: How the Genetics, Biotech, and AI Revolutions Will Transform Our Lives, Work, and World. More with Jamie in just a moment. You're listening to Brian Kilmeade Show. Also, Jamie was one of the first to come out and say, there's something wrong about what we've been told by the CDC and everybody else about what's going on with this pandemic. That's the first time Jamie started bursting on the scene publicly, at least on our channel and on this show. So we know that is front and center now. Don't move.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. Jamie Metzl is here. His book, Super Convergence, comes out tomorrow. You got to download it or order it now. How the Genetics, Biotech, and AI Revolutions Will Transform Our Lives, Work, and World. So there's a lot of people, Jamie, that just as I started before, they look at the AI and all this stuff and said, here we go again. I just got used to the iPhone. I just got used to setting my phone as my alarm. And now I got to get used to a whole different generation. But you can't sit this out.
You cannot sit this out. And it's scary for all of us, no matter who we are. You know, we learn something and then we get settled. But the nature of our societies now is change. And so, again, the reason why I've written the book is if you say, oh, I have to learn AI – and now I'm going to learn coding and I'm going to have some kind of horribly boring series of lectures. It's a bridge too far for most of us, maybe myself included. But if you say, hey, I'm going to have a friend, like talking through this, like sitting at the beach, sitting with a friend.
You do a book on tape too?
I do. Okay. I didn't do the full recording, but I wanted people to hear my voice. And so I recorded a welcome message to everyone. And this is book number 6. I put into my contract that I got the final okay for who would be the narrator. So I reviewed about 20 different people. I chose a really great narrator.
Great. So let's talk about some of these things. First off, when we first met with COVID-19, how is this going to stop the next pandemic? Well, what did you learn from the last series of things we were told to do that were totally wrong?
Well, so maybe I'll start with the first question. So the reason why I felt like I had a pretty clear vision on COVID-19 origins in the beginning is that before that, with my work and my last book on the future of human genetic engineering, I was deeply involved with what happened with those Chinese CRISPR babies, which was an absolute outrage. And so I knew
– I don't know what that is.
So in 2018, there were these genetically engineered babies that were born in China. They were the pre-implanted embryos were genetically altered by a very unethical Chinese scientist named He Zhongkui. And so I had written about that. I was a member of the World Health Organization Expert Advisory Committee on Human Genome Editing created after that. And so when the COVID story started, and it was in Wuhan, which I knew was the center of biotechnology research in China where these horseshoe bats are more than 1,000 miles away, it may be really suspicious. And I knew and from my life and from my work that we are entering an age of the technical word is synthetic biology. But what I said earlier, it's essentially human re-engineered life. We now have the tools to manipulate life. And sometimes, like in healthcare, where we're saving people's lives through gene therapies, that's incredible. But there are also real dangers that using these exact same tools, we can do terrible things. And I believe
that's a terrible thing.
That COVID-19 is one of those terrible things. And that's why we need to say, hey, we are at this new stage where humans have these new superpowers. And if we want to make sure they're used wisely, that we can't say, oh, our elected officials, they're going to do it, or some experts are going to do it. It's up to all of us to make sure that we are playing a role in building that kind of future. And that doesn't mean that everybody is writing legislation, but it does mean that we're all educating ourselves, we're engaging with our communities, with our elected officials and others.
Well, the problem is I'll never trust Russia and China to hold themselves to the standard we're going to hold. Yeah. So there's a danger there. Right?
There's an absolute danger. So this is a sneak peek. But I'm a member of the Heritage Foundation Commission on China and COVID-19. We're going to be coming out with our final report next month. And it's all about how do we hold China accountable for COVID-19? Because if China can spark the worst pandemic in a century, 27 million excess deaths, according to The Economist, and just get away with
it.
And then just get away with it. If we have the exact same scenario at some point in the future, they're going to do the exact same thing. So accountability is not about some kind of malicious retribution. It's transparency and accountability are the tools that we use to make sure we can be as safe as possible in the future.
You also said that this could help feed the world.
Absolutely.
Agriculture.
Yeah.
In what way? Is it just looking at putting everything you know about agriculture in and trying to maximize what we're doing?
Well, it's certainly about trying to maximize what we're doing. So 100 years ago, we had 2 billion humans on Earth. Today, we have a little more than 8 billion humans on Earth. The reason we were able to jump from 2 to 8, quadrupling over a mere century, is because of agriculture, because of industrial agriculture, the new seed varieties, the synthetic fertilizers that I'm sure you have lots of farmers and lots of farmers who are probably listening to this right now while you're in your compound.
And don't worry.
And these farmers, you know, people, unsophisticated New Yorkers think, oh, these farmers, they're a bunch of yokels, whatever. The farmers, both the plant farmers and the animal farmers, are some of the most sophisticated people. You need to know a ton.
Right.
And so they know a lot about these seed varieties. And so just like we've tripled agricultural productivity over the last 70 or so years with the United States taking the lead, we need to continue to create seeds that are more productive. We need to have agricultural practices that can get more yield out of these same amounts of land or even less land. And that's – and these tools of biotechnology can do it. Animal agriculture, about half of the arable land on Earth is for agriculture. Three-quarters of that supports animal agriculture. That's to feed and graze, and so it's huge. And these industrial animal farms are feeding us, and they're giving us the animal products, but they have side effects, whether it's climate or environment or overuse of antibiotics or all sorts of things. And so we can innovate using – there's a thing I know some people are scared of it – cell-cultured animal products where you have the healthiest animals that you can. You take a few cells and you grow them in bioreactors. And the key to this is to make the farmers winners. This isn't science versus farmers. It's science with farmers.
That will be a great – so don't fear it. Welcome it. And that, you know, when you're on the farm, a lot of times, not every day, you have a moment to read and pick up Jamie's book, Super Convergence: How the Gen X Biotech and AI Revolutions Will Transform Our Lives, Work, and World. See you tomorrow on Fox and Friends.
Awesome. Can't wait, Brian. Thanks.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show right here from Midtown Manhattan, where I know the former president of the United States is going to be talking to a probation officer today in New York City, but he could stay at Mar-a-Lago. Why didn't he go to New Jersey? Usually he's in New Jersey by now at Bedminster, but he's staying at Mar-a-Lago to do it, and they're going to be on a secure line, but they all agree that him coming to New York with all the SUVs and the travel and the lockdown, you know, we'll see what happens there. We're also looking at the latest Hunter Biden situation. He will not testify, which makes one believe the experts agree that they could wrap up their defense as early as today. When they're trying to find out, did he buy a gun illegally? Did he lie on that form? You know, his dad's big into guns, so that's what happens. Goes to the letter of the law. Don't lie on that form. With me this hour is going to be Gerard Baker, editor-at-large of the Wall Street Journal, and also Dr. Marty McCary is standing by. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
We will succeed. That was 3 years ago. Since then, 6.5 million migrants have been apprehended along the southern border. It would be very hard to call that a success.
Yeah, I would say so. Martha Raddatz, as skeptical as you and I are about the practicality of shutting down the border with this administration. Border matters to all of you. This, according to a new, despite a new executive order by Joe Biden, nobody thinks he's taking it serious. What has changed? Get this. CBS does a poll. 62% of the American people are on board with Donald Trump's idea of mass deportations of illegals.
Number two.
The forces came under fire from a 360-degree threat. RPGs, AK-47s, explosive devices on the way, mortar rounds. It was and is a war zone.
Yes, it is. Four hostages rescued. One government minister resigns. And the pursuit of Hamas leadership continues. There is no ceasefire deal. We'll have the latest.
Number one.
We're going to do the things that you've wanted to do. We're going to bring it back to 4 years ago and do even more. We did, you know, people are saying to themselves, were we better off 4 years ago or are we better off now? And it wasn't even close.
That is true. So far, the polls reflect that. 2024, Trump in full stride on the campaign trail in a strange place. He is out west. He is making a lot of money with Silicon Valley. He raised a lot of money in Newport Beach, and then he raised a lot of money in Nevada, where there's a primary tomorrow. So we'll take a look at that. One of the big stories that's going to be in the future and was last week was Dr. Anthony Fauci. As he went to Capitol Hill and said essentially, yeah, I don't know where 6 feet apart came from. I was always open to this being a lab leak for the cause of this pandemic. And I was never heavy-handed about enforcing legislation when it comes to mandating the vaccine. We found out that's not totally true. And fundamentally, they're both going to be asked to come back and go under oath again and answer more questions. Dr. Marty McCary was one of the first professionals, esteemed professionals, to come out and with and express real skepticism when it came to what's happened with COVID-19 and our reaction to it, and joins us now. Dr. McCary, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Brian.
So when I watched Dr. Anthony Fauci, I got it's the most aggravating testimony I've ever seen. I watch him sit there and try to tell us that, you know what, not really my fault, all these mandates, the 6 feet apart. Not really my fault that COVID-19 people are bitter towards vaccine mandates. It really was all about him.
He's slick. I mean, look, he is, they pulled every email he's ever had during COVID, and we basically found nothing. You know, we found a bureaucrat who knows how to evade anything that's documented. He was having all kinds of secret meetings with scientists who were telling him, look, this came from the lab. And, you know, then has this basically this cover up. So the guy is slick. He's sharp. And what you saw during that hearing was he distanced himself from the CDC, from even his own people at the NIH that approved and signed off on gain of function research. He created this kind of distance. I wish they would have asked him about this relentless push for gain of function research over the prior 10 years before COVID, him, you know, advocating for virus hunters to go into remote caves and pull viruses never seen before by humans. The 2018 experiment where researchers in Dr. Fauci's division at NIH published an article saying they took a Wuhan coronavirus in Montana and tried to infect bats with it. Like, how did those viruses get there? You know, that's where we actually have the clues as to where COVID came from from within U.S. activities.
And what about things like this, Dr. McCary? Without the medical degree, even I could pick up when people are lying to me, especially when about science. When you have a key advisor that worked with you for 20 years come out, and we have text messages exposed and emails that have come out that show we can back channel with Anthony Fauci. I can go to his house if we have to with Tony. And this, talking about back channels, when asked about it, he said, he wasn't my advisor. Well, he worked with you for 20 years. I don't know anything about a back channel. Really? Because this whole rumor about you working behind the scenes to suppress the skepticism was revealed, and they have a plan to circumvent the Freedom of Information Act all down there. And he sits there like Phil Rizzuto and comes back and goes, well, not really. I don't know, really know what he's talking about. And he gets a pass on that. For a guy like you that took a lot of slings and arrows when you came out, that must anger you.
Well, pretty much everything that I said, Jay Bhattacharya said, and others has come true now. The data has caught up with these guys, and they've learned to wiggle around. You're talking about Dr. David Morins, by the way, Dr. Fauci's right-hand man, who Dr. Fauci tried to create a lot of distance from during his hearing. Like, oh, I barely know that guy. What's his name again? That kind of thing.
Meanwhile, he says he goes to Tony's house.
Yeah, the guy goes to Tony's house. He had three scheduled one-on-one meetings with Tony Fauci every week. Does that sound like a guy you barely know and you don't? This is his fixer. This is his right-hand man, and he is basically in email. He's not as slick as Dr. Fauci, so he actually had incriminating things. He got caught. The woman that taxpayers fund at the NIH to ensure that the media can get access to emails through Freedom of Information Act, that woman advised them on how to evade the Freedom of Information Act. I mean, that's incredible. Mm-hmm. And then it's a little picture into the deep state within our health agencies.
So I wanted you to hear this exchange really caught me, because Rich McCormick is a congressman, but he's also a military guy, and he's also a doctor. And he was seething in this delivery. And he played this excerpt from a book on tape. And I'm sorry if you've heard this already, but I want Dr. McCary to react.
You believed an institutional should make it hard for people to live their lives so they'd feel pressured to get vaccinated. Could we run the audio clip on that, please?
You think can be done about it? I have to say that I don't see a big solution other than some sort of mandatory vaccination.
You want to come to this college, buddy? You're going to get vaccinated.
Yeah.
Big corporations like Amazon and Facebook and all of those others are going to say, you want to work for us, you get vaccinated. And it's been proven that when you make it difficult for people in their lives, they lose their ideological and they get vaccinated.
Well, where's that Anthony Fauci? The congenial big smile on my face, the bobblehead doll. Now we know exactly what he was like behind the scenes. He said, well, I was taken out of context.
I wish he had that level of enthusiasm to promote people to exercise and not be obese, which is the number one preventable risk factor for COVID mortality, for schools to be open, that sort of enthusiasm to condemn dangerous gain-of-function research. All the vitriol you saw was directed to people who were low risk and chose not to get vaccinated, and people who chose not to wear a cloth mask when they were outdoors by themselves. This intense vitriol. And let's be honest, there he took a partisan took a hit, and basically said, okay, you know what? These are basically conservatives. These are basically Republicans that are unvaccinated. Not true. The biggest, largest group of unvaccinated Americans was African Americans by percentage, but they created a political narrative.
Oh, you know what? Let me play the cut where he condemns the African Americans. Wait a second. I don't have it. Turns out he'd be afraid to do that. But he also likes to distance himself from the policies that he demanded that kept schools closed, like the 6-foot rule. Listen to this.
Once we realized that the virus was not spread by droplets and was aerosolized, did you feel an indication to go back to the CDC and said, let's base this on science. Let's get rid of this 6-foot rule.
I've challenged the CDC multiple times.
Publicly on this regard?
It is not appropriate to be publicly challenging a sister organization.
Not his rule for the 6 feet apart. He said it every day. About 6 feet apart. That's what we need to do. He had us wearing masks outside. My daughter playing soccer with masks outdoors. It was absolutely insane. Go ahead. Your thoughts about the 6 feet apart and blaming Robert Redfield.
Yeah, I mean, I thought what was most fascinating about his response there was he basically said, if I have a belief as a physician, I should not say it because I should never overstep another agency of government. And you got to sneak peek into how government doctors work there.
Yeah, he also had no problem going against Donald Trump when he disagreed. And I have a find it hard to believe that he called up Robert Redfield and said, what should I think today? Lastly, on the lab link, the most maddening thing. Listen to this.
As you sit here today, is it possible that COVID-19 was the result of a laboratory-related accident?
Oh, absolutely. And I keep, like I mentioned multiple times, I keep an open mind. I feel, based on the data that I have seen, that the more likely, not definitive, but the more likely explanation is a natural spillover from an animal reservoir. But since there has not been definitive proof one way or the other, we have to keep an open mind that it could be either.
And based on that answer, I think, is the hypothesis that COVID-19 accidentally leaked from a lab a conspiracy theory?
No, I mentioned that several times. Conceptually, the concept of it is not a conspiracy theory.
Your thoughts, Dr. McCary?
Well, here's what he and Dr. Collins, head of the NIH, were emailing back and forth. I'm going to quote, wondering if there is something the NIH can do to help put down this very destructive conspiracy. Fauci replies, I would do nothing about this right now. It's a shiny object that will go away in time. And that was their view. Now, so the evidence has been coming in on the possibility of a lab leak and the possibility of a natural origin. And almost everything on the natural origin side has been disproven, and there's nothing really to support that side of the ledger. And the side of the ledger supporting a lab leak is now so long and overwhelming. The circumstantial evidence is clear as day. It's a no-brainer. And at the end of this big accumulation of data, Dr. Fauci and Collins put it out there like, yeah, it's kind of a 50-50. I'm still with the natural side. I mean, the Chinese Wuhan lab folks sent us the freaking cookbook on how to make COVID in the 2018 Diffuse grant, which was sent to the United States government. Hey, we're going to take a furin cleavage site, stick it into a bat coronavirus. Now, we didn't fund that particular grant, but one thing that's well known in research is you start the research even if before you get the grant, and you parse money together from other funding streams to do the research that you want to do. So it's very intellectually dishonest to kind of suggest, yeah, it's kind of 50-50. We don't know. We'll never know. I'm still kind of on the natural origin side. I mean, that is intellectually dishonest. And then you have all these scientists rally around them. I mean, these scientists bend over backwards and do mental acrobatics in order to come around and say, yeah, I'm kind of with him on it. Yeah, never mind that, you know, all kinds of stuff happened.
Yeah, and the other thing is he could say, well, I just don't like that theory, or he could be covering up because he might be responsible for what happened by financing and asked the Wuhan labs to do it in America Barack Obama told you not to do, that administration. And finally, the FDA FDA decided they are now in favor of updated COVID-19 shots for the fall. Is that going to be a mandate?
Some schools are still mandating, believe it or not, the COVID vaccine. They're holding on. They might as well wear a Biden hat instead of say you're for these mandates, because it's just a political badge at this point. But America said no to the last COVID booster because no clinical trial was ever run on them. And there is this forever booster mindset in medicine. Just get a booster every year. Don't ask questions. We're going to come up with the booster. We're going to approve it. But Pfizer tells us that it works, or Moderna tells us that it works. Stop asking questions. By the way, Paxlovid, remember that drug?
Sure.
That was the subject of one of the biggest public health campaigns of the last 2 years. Everybody was taking Paxlovid because the White House said to. Two studies in the New England Journal of Medicine last month showing it doesn't work in people under 65. Zero. If anything, prolongs the illness. The studies ended a year and 9 months ago. Why did we learn about it just last month after we spent $10 billion on it?
Right.
And yet when they say, hey, this COVID booster shot, this works, they'll tell us that in a heartbeat without showing us the data. So we're being manipulated right now.
Don't forget to download Dr. McCary's new book, comes out in September, Blind Spots, When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health. Dr. McCary, you're somebody I'll always go to, hopefully, God forbid, the next pandemic or anything else going on, because you'll say things like, I don't know, or we're studying it. Wait for the studies to come out. What do you think? Let me find out. That's what we needed, some humility in your business. And we got mandates and derision. And that's something I think is unforgivable. Thanks so much, doctor.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, back in a moment. I know you have a lot to say. 1-866-408-7669, including this next political correct moment that is like no other. You're not going to believe what just came out. And then Gerard Baker at the bottom of the hour. Don't move.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everybody. It is nice to be with you again. I saw the strangest story ever. And Allison, do you think it's all right to read this out loud?
I do.
Are you sure?
It's the news story.
Okay. So this story is a top cancer charity is apologizing for using the word cervix instead of the trans-friendly front hole. A top cancer charity has apologized for this instead of the trans-friendly number. The Canadian Cancer Society, which is run by the philanthropist Andrea Seal, acknowledged the LGBTQ plus community on a webpage dedicated to cervical cancer. Under the page's Words Matter section, the nonprofit said that many non-binary people and transgender people have mixed feelings of feeling distance from the term cervix. We recognize that many times trans men and non-binary people may have mixed feelings about it, so therefore they're going to use the word front hole. We recognize the limitations of the words we've used while acknowledging the need for simplicity. Another reason we use these words, cervix, is to normalize the reality that men can have these body parts too. Now, do you think this was worthy of an apology?
No, it's insane the fact that they came to this. And men cannot have a cervix. I am sorry.
Eric, do you have any interest in weighing in on this?
Nope.
How crazy is this? Out of all the politically correct stories, this takes... And I'm glad it's Canadian. So at least we can distance ourselves from the front hole controversy.
I'm so glad we can. And I'm also so glad you actually brought up this story because we were unsure if you'd actually say it on the air.
It's on the rundown.
It is.
I have an obligation to the people.
I actually hope we're getting pranked. And it's actually not a real story, but I don't
think
it's
would be great. I hope I'm being pranked.
Me too.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
There were echoes of Ronald Reagan in the speech.
And there was a reason for that.
And a very good reason, talking to Reagan Republicans, maybe Nikki Haley Republicans, Republicans who feel like Donald Trump doesn't represent where the Republican Party should be, where the United States should be. That's a hard argument to make, given how Donald Trump has remade the Republican Party in his image. There are still people, and they may make a difference in some places, who aren't comfortable with Trump, won't vote for him. But to see the way that donors have lined up, to see the way that elected officials have lined up, almost without exception, including Nikki Haley herself saying she would vote for him, tells you where the party has moved, and they have shifted behind Donald Trump.
Listen, I couldn't predict it after 2022. That was Rick Klein, ABC political director, and he's one of these guys. You can say whatever you want. You could say the most negative thing about Trump, the most positive thing. He's not going to change because he goes into the numbers and trends. He's 100% right. Silicon Valley, who famously, Niles Ferguson told me he is from Hoover Institute. He's really an esteemed guy. He said, after 2016, he said to me, I'll never forget it. He said, you know, do you realize how angry Silicon Valley is? I said, why? He goes, because Donald Trump made him look bad. He was able to use Facebook and social media to propel himself to the presidency, and they're all embarrassed, and they're vowing revenge. I said, well, interesting, vowing revenge. How could they do it? Look at the Twitter files. Look at how they conspired to shadow ban certain people to make sure Trump's message didn't get out. What they did in 2020 to make sure that the laptop and 51 Intel, all of them, social media worked together to make sure that Donald Trump, number one, had to overcome a fake Russia investigation, and then he had to overcome social media, shadow banning, and flat out banning in the end. Now, David Sachs, big Silicon Valley CEO, thanks to J.D. Vance's connection, came out and endorsed Trump. And then he got together his buddies and they spoke for it. They had a 2-hour meeting. People paid to get in. The former president made $12 million. At which time, I thought it was so interesting. J.D. Vance, I said, what was it like in the meeting when the doors closed? He said, fascinating. I said, why? As Trump gave a speech, much different speech than he gives to the big crowds. I said, why? He goes, he was just very give and take. And then at one point, when it comes to AI, he said, what should I know about AI? And some guy put up his hand and said, this. He goes, what bothers you most about what's happening now? What worries you most? He is actually using the give and take. He goes, okay, I get that. Now, why would a 77-year-old guy know a lot about AI? I mean, there's so much to keep up with. He's got his own court cases in the air. But that's what he does. And it goes very consistent with Doug Burgum told us on the show. I can't remember if it was on air or not. He came out and said he's with all these oil executives. And he sat down there for 3 hours and he heard all their complaints, what they like, what they didn't like. Why is production so high yet people are so upset? Why is the number so high? What has taken place over the last few years? What could change the price? What could change production? What could maximize profit? How do you drill? He said it was a million questions. And that's why most of these people leave these meetings and find out they're very impressed and they don't get the guy that hosted The Apprentice or has some crazy tweets about Rosie O'Donnell. Gerard Baker joins us now with the Wall Street Journal. Gerard, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, he's at large there. And Gerard, a couple of things. You're also author of American Breakdown, Why We No Longer Trust Our Leaders and Institutions and How We Can Rebuild Those Confidence. I mean, I just did half hour ago with Dr. Marty McCary, all how Dr. Fauci destroyed anything positive we thought about the CDC. And we'll never trust them again. That's one of the institutions. But this president's having success right now, running on his past record. I'm looking at these poll numbers. He's winning on immigration by double digits, winning on the economy by double digits, winning on the Israeli-Hamas war on double digits. On election integrity, it's a flat-footed tie. How has this happened?
I mean, look, we've had so many examples like this. Brian, and again, thank you for mentioning my book. It is about trust, and it's about the failure of our leaders to earn the trust of the American people. And you see it everywhere. You see it in government. You see it in these public health care officials. You see it in business. I'm sorry to say, in big business, it's just a widespread problem, and it's one of the main reasons people are voting against, you know, what they see as the established party, against what they see as the established power. That is, particularly the Democrats, who's, by the way, most of these elites are supporting the Democrats, whether it's in the media, business, academia, and they are voting against them. They're voting, and it's one of the reasons Donald Trump has been so successful. So I see this as a big, you know, kind of a democratic, as an electoral revolution that's taking place.
It's right before our eyes. And even though the president on July 11th could be looking at a prison sentence, is that hard for you to believe?
It's not that hard for me to believe, Brian, because we have seen this process of the weaponization of justice, of using the law to go after political enemies, particularly on the left. And they did it with Donald Trump. And, you know, I think it's but as we know, is that, you know, this, Brian, and I think your listeners know this too very well. It's backfiring on them. More and more people are seeing it for what it is, which is not, look, you and I have had many conversations before. I think Donald Trump has done a lot of things he shouldn't have done, and I think he has a lot of questions to answer. This case, this Manhattan case, is an absurd and unjustified prosecution based on purely political motives by the DA here in New York. No one else, as it's widely acknowledged, supposedly is guilty, if that's the right word, of committing these bookkeeping offenses, would ever be charged with a misdemeanor, let alone a felony. But this has just been an attempt that Trump's enemy. Trump has this amazing ability to rile up his enemies, to try to and to persuade them to do things that they think are going to destroy Donald Trump, but end up destroying themselves. And I think that's where we're going to be with this Manhattan case. Even if, as you say, he gets sentenced, He will be sentenced on September 7th, even if the judge, you know, clearly hasn't demonstrated himself to be a completely neutral arbiter, even if the judge ends up sending him to jail.
That really worries me. I mean, to think that the backlash will be indescribable if you take the guy who's winning in maybe 35 to 40 states and you put him in jail for the 6 months of his campaign. I mean, are you kidding? I mean, for things that, I mean, this isn't murder. It's like, well, he got drunk one night and he killed somebody. This is something that makes no sense. That should have been, there was something that happened in 2007 that should have been brought up in 2016, which conclusion should be embarrassing to the country. But what they're going to do is try to make Donald Trump unelectable. And they're doing it by, in this way. Listen to Chris Matthews, cut 13.
I'm telling you, Trump could end up rolling the score. I've got the Congress. I've got the Supreme Court. I own it all. I am a dictator. It's very reasonable to assume that's where he's headed.
Andrew McCabe, cut 14.
I mean, people are actually worried about being thrown in jail or grabbed in some sort of extrajudicial detention. And I think, you know, as crazy as this sounds in the United States of America, I think people should really consider that these are possibilities.
So, I mean, is he kidding? Andrew McCabe and Chris Matthews, he's going to be a dictator. He's going to just start randomly throwing people in jail.
Yeah, I don't think they see the irony. Well, maybe they do, but they refuse to acknowledge it. There's the incredible, you know, the irony, the contradiction of the irony here in this, that again, as we've just said, Trump, if he goes to jail, if he's sentenced in some way on July the 11th, you know, on what, again, what is widely acknowledged to be politically trumped up, forgive the pun, charges. You know, who's the bigger threat to democracy? Who is throwing opponents in jail? I mean, you know, actually, when Donald Trump was president, yeah, he campaigned a lot on lock her up with Hillary Clinton. But actually, when he got into office, he didn't do anything, right? They didn't put the arms of the law onto, you know, to grab Hillary Clinton. He walked away from that. It's these Democratic prosecutors. It's these far left Democrats who control these. You know, whether it's parts of the Justice Department or whether it is state governments or county governments, in the case here in New York, it's these prosecutors who are with political motivation who are going after their political enemies. So it's just, again, I just find the kind of, you know, the lack of self-awareness that these people display when they say that it's Trump who's going to be doing all this when they're doing it themselves.
So, Gerard Baker, our guest, The Wall Street Journal. Gerard, are you shocked that he made $12 million in Silicon Valley? David Sachs put together a group. Tickets range from $5,000 to $250,000. Are you amazed that he went out to Nevada and did what he did, and he went to Newport Beach? And where he goes, people line up in the streets. I mean, I know this election's going to be close, but how is it that one candidate can't drove 12 people and the other one could go into a blue state like California and get this type of passion? Do you see the boats lined up outside the event in Newport Beach? They just wanted to see if they get a glimpse of him. I mean, this is the guy that lost the last election.
Yeah, well, people are riled up. I mean, it does often happen. I mean, the one thing we can say about this election with real confidence is that Joe Biden is incredibly unpopular. People, you know, across the political spectrum, including many in his own party, let's be clear about that, think that he has been... you know, a failed president, aren't at all happy about the fact that he's running again. And they do look back. A lot of people look back and think, look, you know, they maybe, especially last year, the pandemic of the last year of the Trump presidency was a disaster. But that was because of the pandemic. Before that, they look back at that period and, you know, yeah, the economy was in good shape. Inflation was less than 2%. Unemployment was lower than it is today. There was peace around the world, especially, I will say, from the business side. And, you know, I do a lot of reporting on among businesses at The Wall Street Journal. Businesses felt like they were being taken seriously by Donald Trump, that he was listening to them, that he was, you know, he was in favor of deregulation to help them succeed. So I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all that people are, firstly, so unhappy with Joe Biden that they really are eager to get behind the man they think can beat him. But secondly, also that they look back on that Trump presidency now and say, you know, things were better then. Do we really want to do another 4 years?
So your editorial story in The Wall Street Journal last week really caused ripples. And they talked about people behind the scenes saying he absolutely has slowed down. They chronicled the Ukraine meeting for aid where the stuff he said was he whispered so low people could barely hear him, barely participated, would just call on other people, walked around the table so slow it actually delayed the meeting 10 minutes, and had anonymous people weigh in, and they had people not anonymous like Kevin McCarthy go on the record. Your thought about that column and how it was received and ripped on the left?
Yes, yeah, so again, just to be clear, it wasn't my column. It was a news story in the Journal, which documented, as you say, quoted 40 people saying that 45 was Biden was slipping. I'm not surprised at the anger that it provoked on the left, but I'll say two things about it, Brian. Again, by the way, I know nothing about the reporting. I'm not involved in that reporting. I didn't do it. But I would infer two things from what I read there. Firstly, it's true. Everybody knows it. I mean, when I read the story and it said, I think the headline on the story was "Behind closed doors, Biden is seen as slipping." And I thought, my first reaction was, behind closed doors? Everybody sees it in the open every day. What I've heard from people who see, I don't speak to President Biden, but what I've heard from people who do frequently speak to him is that it's very, very come and go. One day he actually may be quite on and quite alert and listening to them. The next day he can't remember the conversation he's had the day before. So the first thing he says, the story is true. The second thing I think, Brian, the most interesting thing about the story, and again, I say this, a speculation not on the basis of any knowledge about how the story was put together or who those anonymous sources were, but you are seeing more and more of these stories about how Biden is slipping. And I think you have to infer from that that there are people inside the White House, certainly inside the Biden campaign, certainly inside the Democratic Party, who are terrified that Biden's going to go down to a heavy defeat here, and they want to get him out. And so they are putting these stories out, not that they're full stories, I'm not saying that at all, but they're putting these stories out to the press that he's just not up to the job anymore, in the hope that between now and the convention, he will be prevailed upon to step down. They will get somebody else at the convention who they think has a better chance.
Yeah, maybe Republicans shouldn't push that hard. And finally, just let's end with Trump. Here's what Dana White, his good friend, the president of UFC, told me about Trump and why he's received so well at UFC events. Cut 19.
Number one, take any of the greatest fighters of all time. Trump is number one. The most resilient human being that I've ever met in my life.
In what respect?
Why keep doing this? Yeah. You know, you got money. You got a great life. You got whatever. Why keep doing this? And the one thing that I can tell you, and this is a fact, this guy loves this country, right? And he loves all Americans, regardless of what color, religion, or whatever it is. He's not a racist. He's a good human being, and he loves America, and he cares about this country. Period. End of story.
That's not an insignificant. Yeah, they've been friends for a long time, even before he approached The Apprentice. And now Dana White's this global sports titan. But that's how he described how he's received and how would they interpret him at UFC events, which represent the next generation of fight fans? I mean, everyone under there seems under 30.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Trump is making inroads into voters we know, whether they're minorities or young people that we haven't seen before. But I mean, one of the big questions, I think, for the election, and it still looks close, at least in the national polls so far, is whether those people come out and vote. I mean, it's one thing to go to a UFC fight or, you know, to a NASCAR event or whatever and shout, let's go Brandon, and shout pro-Trump symbols. It is another to question whether or not many of those, particularly younger voters who don't tend to vote as much as older voters, whether they come out and vote. And that remains, by the way, Biden's, I think, best hope, that particularly in those swing states in places like Pennsylvania, Michigan and Wisconsin, whether or not those older voters who tend to come out more and at the moment seem to be, according to the polls, more inclined to vote Biden, whether they will do that. And the big one of the big challenges Trump and the Republicans have is getting those people who are expressing support for him in more numbers than they've had before, actually getting them out to the polls and to vote.
Got it. Jerry Breaker, thanks so much. Pick him up. Read him on the Wall Street Journal. Pick up his book, American Breakdown. Thanks, Jerry. All right, back to wrap things up. Wrapped up this hour in just a moment. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, we'll get the latest on the Hunter Biden trial. It's happening right now.
You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm excited for the girls that are on the team. I know it's the most competitive team in the world, and I know it could have gone either way of me being on the team, me not being on the team. So, you know, I'm excited for them. I'm going to be rooting them on to win gold. I was a kid that grew up watching the Olympics. So, yeah, it'll be fun to watch them. Honestly, no disappointment. Like, I think it just gives you something to work for. You know, that's a dream. You know, hopefully one day I can be there. And I think it's just a little more motivation. You remember that. And, you know, hopefully in 4 years, when 4 years comes back around, you know, I can be there.
Well, that is Caitlin Clark talking about being left off the 12-person roster for the Olympic team. And I don't have a problem with it. Everybody else does. Dave Portnoy went off on it and said, you got to be kidding me. That is, it's great. It's going to be great ratings if you put her on the team. It's great marketing if you put her on the team. I think when it comes to the Olympics, you pick your best 12 players. And I don't know. Like, I don't watch enough WNBA games, but nobody thinks she's top 12 in the whole league. I mean, some of these women have been playing in the league for 10 years. She's been there for 10 games. So best player in the college is usually not the best player in the WNBA immediately. Maybe within 5 years she will be. But I have no problem. Evidently, she says they created a monster in leaving her off. She told her coach that. She'll play twice as hard. A lot of people are upset by it. I'm sure NBC's upset by it. Quick note, if you want to see me on stage, and I know you do, History, Liberty, and Laughs Tour, and or have meet and greet opportunities, just go to BrianKilmeade.com. June 29th, Shelton Auditorium, Indianapolis, Indiana, and then in Stroudsburg at the end of July. Go to BrianKilmeade.com, find out more. See you in person.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.